Well, let me open with a word of prayer today. Dear Lord, our Heavenly Father, oh, you're heavenly. You're the one who created all things, and you reveal yourself to us in a general sense, to a general audience, in general revelation through your works of creation, as well as a special knowledge of yourself, the triune God, and our Savior in Jesus Christ, in your special revelation, the Holy Scriptures. You are over all things, and you cannot deny or contradict yourself in any revelation. And therefore, we know that the Scriptures are rational, and the knowledge we gain from your works of creation is as well rational. I pray to your Lord that you would teach us by your Spirit, grant us understanding what the ancient Greek philosophers were seeking to do in their study of nature. Give us wisdom, give us discernment for your glory and our good. In Christ's precious name we pray. Amen. Well, today we are looking at the pre-Socratic philosophers again. This is part two. Last time we met, we looked at the Milesians and Heraclitus. Just by way of quick review, philosophy itself is the love of wisdom. Those who are philosophers are lovers of wisdom. We're looking at pre-Socratic philosophers, and we had mentioned why they're called pre-Socratic. Socrates, who died in 399 BC, is the one who first, according to tradition, is the first one of the philosophers to study the nature and order of human social arrangements, the polis, and to say that our laws of civil society and the nature of how we arrange ourselves is not conventional. It's not just chaotic of mere human will of whatever it wants to be, but there's something by nature that takes place according to the order of how we are, not just as individuals, but as social creatures. It was Aristotle, who died in 322 BC, who described the first philosophers as those who discourse on nature. As those who discourse on nature. And we talked about that last time we met. And that's what the pre-Socratics are doing, as we will continue their quest to understand the nature of things. As Gordon Clark said, he was a Christian philosopher in the 1900s, the 20th century, he said, only the rational is capable of being understood. All the rest is gibberish. Only if it's rational can I convey an idea from my mind to your mind that is understandable. And it was Thomas Aquinas, who died in 1274 AD, who said that God is over all things, theology, meaning scripture, as well as nature, meaning science. That there's unity to it all. There's not two realms of contradiction, but they all flow from who God is, and he cannot deny himself, and therefore both realms are rational and consistent with one another. And if we've got a contradiction between them, it's in our own understanding. Either we've read the Bible and misunderstood it, misinterpreted it, or we have studied nature scientifically, rationally, and misunderstood that. It's one or the other. Gordon Clark also said that arguing, serious arguing, is philosophizing, as we will see again today. Arguing, serious arguing, is philosophizing. And again, anyone who says that the science is settled, run from that person. They are not a part of Western civilization. It's one of the reasons, you know, we include the ancient Greeks, a part of Western civilization, even though they do not formally acknowledge the Lord Jesus Christ. They did not know about the Lord Jesus Christ. They did not have the Holy Scriptures. But yet, that's where republican forms of government begin in human history. We formed a republic in America, but as well, they were scientists and believe the world was rational, as we do as Christians. We are scientists and believe the world is rational. And by and large, the ancient Greek philosophers rejected the irrational pagan mythology of the gods and goddesses of ancient Greece. We mentioned that the first philosophers were on a quest, a search to understand the arche, the root of which all things are made, or of which all things exist. What is the fundamental stuff of all things? What's the supreme essence or substance of all things? And in that quest to understand the arche, or root of all things, you end up facing that fundamental recurring problem of the one and the many. How there is structure and order and unity in a world, but also diversity. How there is change, but also things that seem to be solid and consistent and no change. And how do you explain it? Well, we mentioned ancient Greek philosophy began with Thales, who was a Milesian, because he was of Miletus, that city in Asia Minor. And Thales accurately predicted a solar eclipse. So he said, before it took place, he said, this solar eclipse is going to take place on May 28th, 585 BC, and it did. Because he discerned regularity in cosmology and how things are motioning in the universe. There's regular motion, patterns, uniformity, and therefore you can make predictions for the future. And that is what he did and accurately predicted a solar eclipse on May 28th, 585 BC. And that is where, as Gordon Clark says, ancient Greek philosophy began, on that very day. Well, R.C. Sproul pointed out that there were two crucial questions that all boiled down to among the ancient Greek philosophers, the first philosophers, the pre-Socratic philosophers studying the nature of things. The two crucial issues is ultimate reality one or many? Is it one? Is it monism? Or is it more than one, pluralism? And then as well, another question is it physical, corporeal, or is it incorporeal, spiritual, non-physical? And you can have different combinations of those two. By way of review, we looked at the Milesians, and they're called that because they were of the city Miletus in Asia Minor, which is Turkey today. Thales died in 546 BC. You remember he said, all is water. The arche, or root of all things, is water. So it's a form of corporeal monism. All is physical and one, ultimately water. Anaximenes, a Milesian, he died 528 BC. He believed that all is air. Anaximander died 546 BC. He believed that all is indefinite. All is indefinite. Boundless is another term for that. What we might call infinite. And there's a certain sense there where Anaximander is looking at a transcendent, something boundless, something infinite. And that hints at a little bit more consistency with Romans 1:20. The eternal power and Godhead are clearly seen, being understood through what has been made. The Godhead, something that transcends that which is. And Anaximander understood that to avoid circular reasoning, it has to be something that transcends something that already is here. Because if you say all is water, water is one of the things that has to be explained. So then it becomes circular reasoning. We said as well, for these, they overestimated, from our perspective as Christians, they overestimated the power of human reason to say that the human mind can understand all. All is water. All is air. Can the human mind really understand that? So that's where rationalism always overestimates the power of the human mind. We are rational, but we do not embrace rationalism. We also looked at Heraclitus. So the ancient Greeks believed that there were basically four fundamental things in the world, whether it be earth, air, water, or fire. Heraclitus, he died in 475 BC. He would also be regarded as one of the Milesians, but he was not from Miletus, that city. So he was living in Ephesus in Asia Minor. But he was similar. He was along the lines of the Milesians. He said that the arche, or root of all things, is fire. Now, fire is the most dynamic of those four fundamental things. It's changing all the time. But remember, his famous saying accurately is this: on those stepping into rivers staying the same, other and other waters flow. I'll say it again. On those stepping into rivers staying the same, other and other waters flow. So Heraclitus, even though he says the fundamental arche, or root of all things, is fire, something constantly changing, and therefore all of reality is in a sense changing, yet he says there's some level of reality that stays the same. On those stepping into rivers staying the same. Rivers are still rivers. Houses are still houses. Human beings are still human beings. But other and others' waters flow. Humans get older, grow, houses decay and break down. But horses always remain horses, houses, houses, people, people, rivers, rivers. And what is that power behind or in creation, in, they wouldn't say creation, but what is that power in all things to maintain that order? So horses remain horses, people, people, houses, houses, rivers, rivers. What power is there in all things to keep everything the same? Heraclitus, you remember, Heraclitus, he's the one, as far as we know, is the first one to put forth the term logos. He died 475 BC. And he's the one that put forth the term logos. That's the same word that John used, the Apostle John, in John 1, 1 through 3. But it's a term that is a broad term that can mean lots of different things. Book, word, ratio, theory, argument, logic. So in other words, he really didn't know, but he's saying there's got to be something, some power there that maintains the order. And here again, this is Romans 1:20. That God's eternal power and Godhead are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. It's eternal power. There's something power there that maintains it all. To them, it was impersonal, not personal, not a personal almighty God, but there is, in a sense, then a recognition. And that's where Paul knows all this, the Apostle Paul, all this whole history when he's writing that about the Gentiles in Romans 1, 20 and 21. Well, there is another group. This is new material than today. Again, arguing, serious arguing is philosophizing, as Gordon Clark said. Well, we have another individual, Pythagoras. He died in 500 BC. Other than not living in Miletus, there is a sense in which Pythagoras could have been regarded as one of the Milesians. Because like them, Pythagoras believed all things are made fundamentally of a certain stuff. And before I say what it is, I want to kind of build the argument on it. Now, many of you know or are aware of Pythagoras because you've come across the Pythagorean theorem somewhere along the line, probably in school. Right? Geometry began with the ancient Greeks. Pythagoras was in southern Italy, and he developed his theory of numbers. Although we know little of Pythagoras' own views, since not much remains of his writings, He influenced others who studied at his school in southern Italy. For example, many years after Pythagoras died, Pythagoras died 500 BC, but many years after he died, Plato, who died in 347 BC, had visited the Pythagorean community in southern Italy and was influenced by their thinking. So the next time we meet, Lord willing, when we look at the sophists, Socrates, Plato, and then get into Aristotle, Plato is influenced by Pythagoras and his students. Pythagoras was a philosopher who was also religious, and he embraced what is known as Orphism. Orphism. O-R-P-H-I-S-M. Orphism. Orphism taught that the human soul is a divine being imprisoned in the body. Orphism taught that the human soul is a divine being imprisoned in the body. If you know some on Plato, then you know how Plato, in a sense, is influenced by Pythagoras and his students, since the real realm of reality is in ideas, and we live in the shadows. Now, though religious, Pythagoras, as a rational philosopher, he had rejected the irrational mythology of ancient Greek religion, of their gods and goddesses, as did most of the other ancient Greek philosophers. For Pythagoras, human souls are divine because they are rational. For him, the human soul is a divine being imprisoned in the body, and the reason the human soul is a divine being is because it's rational. So for him, then, in his religion, salvation comes through knowledge. There's this sense in which it gains more and more knowledge over time through thinking and philosophizing and becomes more pure and then finally is released back to the realm of the divine. There's a sense, then, in which his goddess is human reason. His god or goddess, if you want to say it that way. But that's where John Frame would say most of the ancient Greek philosophers, that's what they did, really, is they deified. They wouldn't call it a religion. Most of them weren't explicit about it. Pythagoras is. But most of them were not, where they were committed to being rational, but they deified the human reason without saying it. He just plain says it. As a rational philosopher, Pythagoras was scientific. That's what we mean by these ancient Greek philosophers were scientific. They were rational. They were studying nature and wanted to know the nature of things being scientific. And when they were studying the nature of things, the idea is studying the rational nature of things, how things are structured and ordered. Again, if something's not rational, it cannot be understood. If all you have is constant change and that's it, just a flow of chaotic change, nothing can be understood. It has to be rational to be understood. There has to be permanent categories of things, unchanging things. Now, he discovered several things. Okay, he discovered, and this is the Pythagorean theorem, he discovered with a right triangle that the square of the hypotenuse. So a right triangle, the hypotenuse is the longer side, right? Remember your geometry. He discovered that the square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares of the other two sides. So consider a right triangle where the hypotenuse is 5 inches, and you as well have the left side 3 inches and then the bottom side 4 inches. 3 inches, 4 inches, and the hypotenuse is 5. 5 squared is 25, right? 3 squared is 9. 4 squared is 16. 9 plus 16 is 25. The square of the hypotenuse equals the sum of the square of the other two sides. That's something he discovered. That's something rational. It's structured word in our universe. He has a theory of numbers. The Pythagoreans also discovered harmonious combinations of musical notes that arise from different vibrations related by simple fractions. So our modern scales of music owe their origin chiefly to the insight of the Pythagoreans. In other words, music is mathematical, music is rational. Without the harmony, music is not music. And just as an aside, I remember reading part of Francis Schaeffer's collected writings, and he talked about one of the irrational neo-pagans of the 1960s Cultural Revolution, who literally tried to make quote-unquote music totally with an instrument that would do random organization, quote-unquote, because there's no organization, of the notes, and recorded it. And all it was a random cacophony of chaos. But somebody tried it and tried to call it music. Total insanity. Music is mathematical. Music is rational. Without the harmony, music is not music. But it was the Pythagoreans who first discovered the mathematical fractional relationship for musical notes. They also viewed medicine and human health in terms of mathematical harmony of various components. So they have various theories for medicine and human health. As one scholar said, they anticipated, in a certain sense, the current biomedical concern for hormonal balances, for hormonal mathematical balances in the human body. And I didn't put it on the board there, but you could also put cosmology. We talked about Thales. You know, Thales accurately predicted a solar eclipse, right, on May 28th, 585 BC. Pythagoras died 500 BC, and the Pythagoreans also believed mathematics was the key to cosmology. In other words, that the stars and the planets move in mathematical motion. Okay? So that's where, again, thinking of where we're going to get to Newton and Einstein and others, a mathematical universe. So as we have seen with the Milesians, Thales believed all is water, Anaximenes believed all is air, Anaximander believed all is boundless. For the Pythagoreans, they said all is number. All is number. Heraclitus, as we've said all is fire. But the Pythagoreans said all is number. And that assertion means more than you think. Okay, it's a different way of looking at it than Einstein did and Newton did. Very different. Similar, but different. But it's used in a pregnant sense. There's much more there than you first think. To say, for the Pythagoreans to say all is number. John Frame summarizes the Pythagoreans this way. He said, since everything is the outworking of a mathematical formula, mathematics is the most ultimate reality. Unquote. Again, the philosophers were looking for the arche, the stuff, the fundamental stuff of which all things are made, and to them it was numbers. So numbers were not abstract class concepts for them. Numbers were not mere formal symbols for the Pythagoreans, as you and I think of them today, or as Newton and Einstein thought of them. No, for the Pythagoreans, the arche, or stuff, of which all things are made, are numbers. Mysterious indeed. And at this point, you know, they have similar problems, just like the Milesians and Heraclitus. Because if all is number, then there's no creator-creature distinction. right? Because if God would exist, he's number. And if we exist, we are number, because all is number. And therefore, there is no creator-creature distinction. So again, the ancient Greeks did not believe in a creator. Okay? It's circular reasoning as well, because numbers are one thing that needs explaining. Where did the numbers come from? Right? So they're one part of the whole that needs explaining. Where did the numbers come from? Why do numbers exist? Now, the Pythagoreans may respond with their religious orphism to say some type of divine reason identified with the human soul is behind the rational mathematical order of the universe. So, there's a certain sense then where they're evidencing Romans 1, 20 and 21, just like the others, that God's eternal power and Godhead are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, but they're refusing to honor God and give thanks. The Pythagoreans did not honor and thank God as the personal, transcendent, rational God who created and rationally sustains all things, who created numbers. But they have to acknowledge there's something there, right? Some divine thing that is rational and is behind it all. Okay, so Heraclitus died 475, Pythagoras died 500 BC. Parmenides is another one, died 430 BC. So a lot of these lives overlap, but we're trying to move it more or less in chronological order. Parmenides, he lived in Elea in southern Italy, and he founded what is known as the Eleatic School of Philosophy. It was around the time that Heraclitus died in 475 BC that Parmenides wrote his main work on nature. Now, there are many, R.C. Sproul's pointed this out too, there are many who would say that the whole history of philosophy is nothing but a footnote to the debate, the arguing between Heraclitus and Parmenides. It's all fundamentally fire and change with the appearance of some structure and order by the Logos, Heraclitus. Or with Parmenides, as we will see, is all one. One. Being, no change. Parmenides did not like philosophers espousing what he believed was nonsense. If water is the arche or root of all things, then are you saying that fire is water? And earth is water and air is water? Is that not contradictory? Something being both what it is and not what it is? At the same time, or in the same relationship? Right? If all is water, then you're telling me that earth is water? Huh? Does it sound nonsensical and contradictory? Now, Parmenides agreed with Heraclitus that human reasoning requires something changeless. That's where Heraclitus, even though he said fundamentally all is fire, fundamentally dynamic, changing, yet people remain people. Houses, houses. Horses, horses. There's something, and to him, some mysterious logos behind it. But without that, you can't have anything rational. So Parmenides agreed with Heraclitus that human reasoning requires something changeless. But where Heraclitus said almost all things are becoming, meaning fire, dynamic, changing, Parmenides said all things are being, meaning no change. And his view, Parmenides' view, is based on the short but profound assertion expressed either being is or whatever is. Now, R.C. Sproul tells a story in his book, Consequences of Ideas, where he said he was a college student studying philosophy for the first time, and his professor said, Parmenides, brought forth this profound assertion. Being is. You know, whatever is. And R.C. Sproul started to laugh, like, what, that's profound? But R.C. Sproul said, as time went on, he said, that is one of the most profoundest things that can be said. R.C. Sproul summarizes Parmenides this way. He says, for Parmenides, if anything exists in an absolute way, it cannot change. That's what he means. Whatever is, is. If anything exists in an absolute way, whatever is, whatever exists in an absolute way, it is. It cannot change. It cannot be and not be at the same time and in the same way. If it is becoming, meaning if it changes in any way, it cannot be being. If it is not being, it is nothing. It must be absolutely or not at all. Unquote. I'll read it again. For Parmenides, if anything exists in an absolute way, it cannot change. Whatever is, is. It cannot be and not be at the same time and in the same way. If it is becoming, it cannot be being. If it is not being, it is nothing. It must be absolutely or not at all. Unquote. Now, this is where Aquinas, during the Middle Ages, in the time of Aquinas, in the Middle Ages, the queen of the sciences is theology. And philosophy should be her handmaiden. Okay? This is where they were scientific, thinking through all these issues, and you and me have to be the same. This is a part of Western civilization. We're in the midst of a transgender chaotic revolution that says all there is becoming. Change. You and me as Christians believe in human beings, and we change. We're becoming. Okay? As Christians, you're a human, I'm a human, and we believe in male and female human beings that do not change. Now, I may have more gray hair right now, maybe a little shorter the older I get, but I'm still a human being. Never cease being a human being, I never cease being a man. Okay? Parmenides, though, when he's working through all of this, this is where we've got to ask, is it a paradox? A paradox literally means something that at first sight seems like a contradiction, but upon further examination, it is not. For Parmenides, he is literally saying, if something involves change in any way, it cannot have being. Now he knows, Parmenides knows, there's no such thing as non-being. Non-being is nothing. Parmenides understood that out of nothing, nothing comes. Whatever is, is. As we have already noted, for the ancient Greeks, there was no concept of a personal, unchanging God who exists in an absolute way. That's what we assert as Christians, that there is a personal, unchanging God who exists in an absolute way. They didn't believe in that, ancient Greeks. So for Parmenides, the physical world is what exists in an absolute way. And therefore, the physical world cannot change. In other words, change cannot be real. It must be an illusion. This is why Parmenides is classified as a monist. Someone who believes that the universe is one, literally. This is hard to grasp in one's mind. Now remember that Heraclitus believed the arche, or root of all things, is ever-changing fire. And in one sense, Heraclitus allowed two levels of reality. One level of reality that does not change, in which we speak of rivers, houses, and human beings and horses. And another level of reality that changes. Waters flowing, houses needing repairs, human beings growing. Parmenides said that what we have for reality is an either-or situation. This is the key to try to understand him. His premise is that it's either-or. Either all is being, meaning does not change, or all is becoming. For Parmenides, whatever is real cannot be both being and becoming. If all is becoming, constantly changing, then the world is not rational, and because nothing exists, then in an absolute way, and therefore all would be not being, and in reality, nothing. Because his fundamental premise is that if anything exists in an absolute way, it cannot change. He does not believe in a personal, unchanging, eternal God who exists in an absolute way. So if something exists in an absolute way, it must be this physical world. Whatever exists in an absolute way cannot change. Whatever is, is. It cannot be and not be at the same time and in the same way. So if it's becoming, if it's changing, it cannot be being. If it's not being, then it's nothing. It must be absolutely or not at all. Now, he's in this predicament because he doesn't believe in a creator. Okay, that's what I want you to see. But Parmenides denied then the reality of change that we observe all around us with our senses. We see or hear or touch or taste. He denied the reality of change which we observe through the five senses. John Frame notes this, quote, "Parmenides is perhaps the most consistent rationalist in the history of philosophy. In the service of reason, he was willing to deny almost entirely the testimony of our senses." Unquote. I'll read it again. John Frame said this, "Parmenides is perhaps the most consistent rationalist in the history of philosophy. In the service of reason, he was willing to deny almost entirely the testimony of our senses." Unquote. Parmenides called his worldview the way of truth, and the worldview which accepts change he called the way of belief or the way of opinion. For Parmenides, real reality is the way of truth. Now, let me just, I want to, from a Christian worldview, this is where theology is the queen of the sciences and philosophy are handmade. I want you to think through our Christian theology through some of this observation of Parmenides. In the Christian worldview, rivers, houses, horses, human beings have being in the sense that they do not change. You know a horse when you see a horse. But they have being in a derived sense, not in an absolute sense. It is, as Paul said in Acts 17:28, it is in God that we live and move and have our being. It is in God that we live and move and have our being. Parmenides is correct that what exists in an absolute sense does not change. There's no becoming. Whatever exists in an absolute sense, there's no change, there's no becoming. Well, God is pure being. God is pure being. He is the power of being in and of himself. He is pure being. God alone exists in an absolute sense, and thus the eternal God never changes. He's pure being. He exists in an absolute sense. He's eternal and unchanging. God created the heavens and the earth, and right now he holds all things together by the word of his power. Right? In him all things consist. He holds it all together by the word of his power. Colossians 1, 16 and 17. Hebrews 1, 3. So the being, the stability, when we observe rivers, houses, horses, human beings remaining the same at one level of reality, that is true. That being that we observe is true. It truly exists, but it's in a dependent, derived sense because God preserves them. He preserves horses as horses, cats as cats, rivers as rivers. He preserves human beings as human beings. He holds all things together. In him we have our being. Okay? Now we change, right? We change, but within predetermined boundaries. So that both the change we observe with our senses is real, and the unchanging essences of things in the thoughts of our mind that correspond to reality are real. Both the change, the becoming, and the being are both real. Or Parmenides says it's either or. And we say it's both for us as creatures, because God is the Logos, true Logos, holding it all together, preserving the being of horses and rivers and houses and human beings. In one sense, then, Heraclitus is closer to the truth than Parmenides, since Heraclitus seems to allow for both being and becoming. Again, I'm a human being. It never changes. I'm a male human being. Being does not change. I can never become a cat or a dog. And I'm a man as a human being. I cannot become a woman. But I'm also becoming. I change. I may get a little fatter, a little older, a little grayer, you name it. My hair may fall out. I change. There's becoming, in other words. And Heraclitus credited the mysterious Logos as the powerful source of this apparent rational stability, this being in the world. Why rivers remain the same and horses remain the same, etc. Parmenides' philosophy is built, though, on an either-or fallacy. Either all is being or all is becoming. As if there's only two choices, and that's why it's a fallacy. There's a third option available to explain the world we observe. God is pure being in an absolute sense. And he created the universe, and it has being in a dependent, derived sense, where God holds it all together and preserves it all of the kinds of things he created in Genesis chapter 1. And there's becoming of created things, changing within predetermined boundaries. Parmenides, as Gordon Clark observes, took corporate monism, saying ultimately the archaea root of all things is one and it's physical, and he took it to its logical end. Gordon Clark said this: if unity is basic, if all is one, then motion, plurality, and differences cannot possibly exist. If one starts with unity, does not one end with unity and unity alone? Unquote. I'll read Gordon Clark again. Parmenides took corporeal monism to its logical end. He was a rationalist. This is what Gordon Clark said. If unity is basic, the fundamental arche of all things, then motion is a form of change. If unity is basic, motion, plurality, and differences cannot possibly exist. If one starts with unity, does not one end with unity and unity only? Unquote. Pure rationalism, and that's where you'll end up, based on your premises. And the question is, are the premises true? Right? That's what you always have to ask with rationalism. Rationalism and logic will give you a certain conclusion based on your premises if your reasoning is sound, but your premises must be correspond to reality. If they do not, then you've got a problem. Parmenides would say the diversity is a myth. It's an illusion. You have an appearance of things moving. He would say that. Your senses observe appearances of change and becoming, but they're not real. They're part of your experience, but they're not real. So Parmenides, listen to how Parmenides tried to describe the real physical world. So to him then, ultimately, the real physical world is a unified, unchanging body, single body. And he would describe it as ungenerated, homogeneous, solid, symmetrical, spherical. Ungenerated, homogeneous, solid, symmetrical, spherical. There's no such thing as differences. There's no such thing as motion. There's no such... It's always one. The ancient Greek monism, always one, but he's in a very scientific, philosophical, rationalist way of saying it. So Gordon Clark says it well. This is what Gordon Clark says. If Parmenides' theory is the logical outcome of corporeal monism, then either we must accept the conclusion of Parmenides or reject corporeal monism. The Greeks who immediately followed Parmenides decided to reject corporeal monism. Accordingly, if the world could not be explained on the basis of one body, obviously it is necessary to explain it on the basis of more than one body. Unquote. So the philosophers that will come after Parmenides will be called pluralists or atomists. See, again, is ultimate reality... R.C. Sproul summarized it well, right? Ultimately, is ultimate reality... one or many? If ultimate reality is one, all is water, well, technically then all is water. That's what Parmenides is saying. Logically, that's what your conclusion will be. It's just one homogeneous body of water. Right? And any other differences you see are an illusion. See, he took it to its logical end. You see? Well, then, everybody's that's going to follow Parmenides is saying, well, you know, I don't want to reject what my physical senses observe. You're telling me everything I sense is wrong. So this is the debate then really between rationalists and empiricists, between rationalism and empiricism. And you ended up with that as well in the Enlightenment, as Lord willing we'll get to when we get that way in American Western Civ going through England. But with the rationalist Descartes versus the empiricist John Locke, you have the same debate going on. And then between them, and then we'll end up with some skepticism of causation by Hume, who died in 1776. And then Kant, Immanuel Kant, who died in 1804, trying to bring together in a broad worldview both rationalism and empiricism. But again, arguing, serious arguing, is philosophizing. So this is kind of the flow of thought then. Say, okay, obviously you guys look at me and say, Parmenides is nuts. Right? Pure rationalist, probably the most consistent rationalist in the history of philosophy. But those who followed him were like, no, we're going to reject corporeal monism. Right? So we have the pluralists, sometimes called the atomists. If ultimate reality is not one, then it must be fundamentally plural or many. Several pre-Socratic philosophers argued a pluralist position. So we're going to look at some of these here. Empedocles, probably mispronounced some of these, but Empedocles, his major work was around 450 BC. Don't really know when he was born or died. But Empedocles, his major work around 450 BC, Anaxagoras, he died 428 BC. Leucippus lived in the 5th century, so in the 400s BC. Don't know when he was born or died. Democritus is another one. He lived almost to be 100 years old. So that's why I put born 460, died 360 BC. Some will say it varies some on the dates on that, but he lived almost 100 years, Democritus. You remember I mentioned Socrates died 399 BC. So this is getting us to the time of Socrates. Okay. Now these philosophers, I named four of them, Empedocles, Anaxagoras, Leucippus, and Democritus. These are pluralists. These philosophers trusted their physical senses. Right? So they rejected Parmenides, the rationalist. These pluralists trusted their physical senses. Change was not an illusion, but something real in the rational world. The change that our senses observe is real in the rational world, is what they're arguing. And there's a couple different groups, okay? There's qualitative atomists and quantitative atomists. Empedocles and Anaxagoras were corporeal pluralists. The ultimate reality is physical and plural. They argued that the physical world is made up of elements with different qualities. So they are known as qualitative atomists, that the physical world ultimately is made up of elements with different qualities. So they are known as qualitative atomists. For Empedocles, physical reality is composed of immutable and eternal particles. And these particles possess being and do not change. That ultimate reality is many, made up of particles that have being, they do not change. And for him, there were four. For Empedocles, there were four such particles. So he's along the ancient Greek thinking then of, he's saying earth, air, fire, and water. Now, if I asked you and said, okay, the way they're looking at it is just saying all the objects we observe are fundamentally composed of certain stuff, and all these stuff are many, he says there's four, and they have being, they never change. And if I ask and say, okay, well, can a certain number of fundamental elements with different qualities explain every physical thing? Can a certain number of fundamental elements with different qualities explain every physical thing? Gordon Clark notes this. He says, essentially, this is the precise position of 19th century chemistry. Think of with the periodic table. You've looked at the periodic table in your chemistry class. Think back in your chemistry class, had the list of the chemical elements in the periodic table. That's the theory of 19th century chemistry that we still have today in our science books. And here they were, 5th century B.C., in the 400s B.C., with this theory on the nature of things. Significantly, Empedocles said that the objects composed of these particles do change as they undergo changes in their composition. So if all things are fundamentally composed of earth, air, fire, and water, they have their different qualities, but how they're composed and make up an object varies. Some have more earth, some have more water, some have more air. And the objects composed of these elements, the objects change. They're becoming. But the elements themselves, the fundamental elements, have being. They do not change. So for Empedocles, this corporeal pluralist that's a qualitative atomist, for Empedocles, one level of reality is being, meaning the elements, the fundamental elements, have no change. And another level of reality is becoming. The objects built by those elements involve change. Now, you say, well, how did this situation arise? For Empedocles, in his theory, all originally was being, as Parmenides asserted, with no change. But opposing forces within nature, which Empedocles called love and hate, or harmony and discord. So in nature, all things begin with pure being. As Parmenides asserted, all things are. But that's the way all things began. But then opposing forces within nature started things in rational motion. Change is a form of motion. And then they begin to compose and make up different objects once they're moving. You see? Empedocles knows that something must cause and maintain rational motion. And for him, the rational cause is some mysterious tension between opposing powers in nature. And it's interesting, we have things called electrons and protons and atoms, subatomic particles. You know, so we know there's opposing forces, negative, positive, magnetic forces. But he's got his own little theory here, right? That he said these opposing forces, he's calling love and hate, harmony and discord, but opposing forces within nature started the rational motion. Things are rational. And you can see then that this is somewhat in line then again with Romans 1, 20 and 21. God's eternal power and Godhead are understood by the things that are made. Empedocles did not honor and thank God as the personal almighty God who created all things and rationally sustains all things. But he knows something. Some power, opposing powers in nature, must start the rational motion. Right? So he just gives it a name. It's impersonal, non-personal forces, opposing forces, love and hate, harmony and discord. But he knows something's got to start the rational motion going. So that's Empedocles. He's a qualitative atomist. There's another one. Anaxagoras, for him, there was more than four. fundamental elements that have being and do not change. He said there were an infinite number of fundamental elements or particles, rather than merely four. Anaxagoras called these infinite number of fundamental elements or particles, he called them seeds, spermata in Greek. Now think for a moment. This is his logic. Whatever is in the effect had to be in the cause. Whatever is in the effect must be in the cause. For Anaxagoras, fire could not produce the earth unless there is already earth in fire. Fire could not cause earth unless there's already earth in fire. Whatever is in the effect must be in the cause. So therefore, there must be an infinite number of these elemental things that have been. And he called them seeds, of these fundamental elements or particles that all things are made of. But there must be an infinite number of them because of the great diversity of things we see in objects. Now, significantly, Anaxagoras also taught the existence of the mind. Nous, N-O-U-S in Greek. So for Anaxagoras, fundamental reality is composed not only of physical matter, but also of mind. In a sense, he's introducing a shade of incorporeal pluralism. There's an infinite number of fundamental elements or particles for Anaxagoras that have being, no change. Called them seeds, but he also said there's the existence of the mind. You say, why did he do that? Why did he introduce this idea of mind? Well, to maintain the rationality of change, there must be some principle or power behind it for it to be rational. What makes it rational? Structured, orderly. He said, well, I'll call it mind. This is similar to Heraclitus's logos, Empedocles' love and strife. Again, this is similar in line with Romans 1, 20 and 21. God's eternal power and Godhead are clearly seen, being understood by the things that have made, so that men are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks. They attribute to some impersonal power the order and structure we see, the power and Godhead of the Creator. But they will not honor Him and give thanks. But they know there's got to be something. It explains it, you see. For all Greek philosophers, the mysterious cause behind the order and structure of the universe is something impersonal within nature. So those two, Empedocles and Anaxagoras, are qualitative atomists. That the physical world is made up of elements with different qualities. Empedocles said there was four with different qualities. Earth, air, fire, and water, they have being, they do not change. And once these opposing forces, love and strife, got them moving, then they combined and formed objects. And the objects themselves are what change. Anaxagoras believed there was an infinite number of fundamental elements or particles with different qualities. Again, he's a qualitative atomist. But he introduced the idea of mind as well for the rational motion. Well, another group of pluralists were the quantitative atomists. Quantitative atomists, that's Leucippus and Democritus. What they believed was that the fundamental atoms of which everything is made all had the same qualities except for size and shape and weight. It's the quantity that matters. The quantity. That is what explains different objects. So again, for the quantitative atomists, they believe that the fundamental atoms or elements of which everything is made all had the same qualities except for size and shape and weight. Gordon Clark notes this. He said, the word atom itself means indivisible. Indivisible. And, you know, we use that term today, right? Atomic energy. Speak of the atom bomb. Well, the word atom itself means indivisible. It was that reason that Democritus invented the term atom and applied it to his elements. Say, where did that term come from? It comes from the ancient Greeks. Democritus, a quantitative atomist. But in his view, these fundamental elements are indivisible. They cannot be divided. Now, when we understand it this way, according to the quantitative atomists, and to say, well, they're indivisible, that means that the chemical elements then of the periodic table are not technically atoms, but are chemical compounds because they can be split. Right? So it's similar to modern chemistry, but a bit different. For quantitative atomists, these atoms moved through space and collided with one another to form objects. On their view, reality consists entirely of atoms and empty space. And every physical thing differs from one another based on a different composition or quantity of these atoms. Quantitative atoms, the fundamental elements or atoms have the same qualities except for size and shape and weight. And in motion, they're here and they're colliding and coming together, and that's how they form objects. And the various objects, physical things, differ from one another based on the different composition or quantity of these atoms. But reality to them is just atoms in empty space then. For Leucippus and Democritus, these quantitative atomists, all qualities can be reduced to quantities. Say it again. For them, all qualities of things must be reduced to quantities. In other words, water is not wet or liquid. Rather, water is a molecule composed of two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom, H2O. All qualities can be reduced to quantities. Okay, this is, you know, they were quite scientific thinking about all this. But all qualities must be reduced to quantities. So that's the way we think of water. What is water? It's quantities. Two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom bonded together. If I asked the question then, but can qualities of objects observed by our senses be reduced to quantities? Now, this is an example from Gordon Clark. Okay? Water is H2O. Okay? If you add a little bit of oxygen to a molecule of water, then you have peroxide. But peroxide does not taste like water, and water does not bleach like peroxide. And in a sense then, qualities of objects observed by our senses can be reduced to quantities. the qualities of things. Does it leach? What does it taste like? Well, just adding a little oxygen to H2O gives you peroxide with a whole bunch of different qualities, right? It bleaches then and does not taste like water. So adding more of the same quantities of atoms to a molecule produces very different qualities. So yes, in a sense, the qualities of physical things can be reduced to the quantities of atoms. So it should be obvious then to all of us that the ancient Greek philosophers were scientists beginning to understand the physical world around them, right? It's amazing. We're talking 5th century B.C., the 400s B.C., thinking through these things. Trying to understand the nature of things, the world around them. Now, for all the pluralists, whether they're qualitative atomists or quantitative atomists, for all the pluralists, the atoms must move. The atoms must move to collide together, right, to form objects. For all of them, the atoms must move. Well, how then do they account for motion, right? We said the qualitative atomists said within nature there's opposing forces, love and hate. Empedocles said that, right? Anaxagoras said mind is behind it, causing the motion. Something's got to cause the motion. And it's rational motion. For the quantitative atomist, Democritus, his response was that rational motion is eternal. You've asked the wrong question. Would say, when did it begin and how did it begin? He said, it's eternal. There is no first motion. Motion has always existed. To Democritus, that quantitative atomist. So by making that assertion, he's saying, hey, the problem of how it began is solved. It's eternal. Motion has always been. So for him, then, all things happen by necessity. All things are moving. Motion, then, is inescapable. If motion is eternal, it's inescapable. So again, Democritus, he addresses the problem of motion by saying motion is eternal. Rational motion is eternal. Which means then everything occurs by necessity and it's inescapable. But what if motion is impossible? What if motion is simply an illusion? Again, arguing serious, arguing is philosophizing. What if our physical senses are not reliable regarding things in motion? What if space does not exist? For the pluralists, there's two things. There's these elements or atoms and space. And they move in space and then collide to form objects, right? Well, what if space is an illusion? One brilliant student of Parmenides argued against the pluralists with these very questions. He is Zeno of Elea. He died 430 BC. Again, Parmenides is perhaps the most consistent rationalist in the history of philosophy. And one of his brilliant students was Zeno of Elea. And he defended his teacher's view that the appearance of becoming, change or motion, is an illusion, and that the appearance of space, the idea of space, is an illusion. Zeno of Elea defended the idea of Parmenides that all is one being, absolute being, no change. How did he do it? Well, his teacher was a pure rationalist, denied everything of the physical senses, right? Parmenides. So his brilliant student, Zeno of Elea, essentially takes the same tactic against the pluralists. He uses the dialectic. He attacks the logic of the pluralists. Reductio ad absurdum. He tries to say, okay, pluralists, let me take your logic and take it to its conclusion and show you it's absurd. That's what he tries to do. If I can show that your arguments lead to absurdity, then I'm defending Parmenides' view. So he's not going to use empirical evidence. Right? He's a student of Parmenides, who is a pure, consistent rationalist, so he's using rational arguments. Aristotle, who died in 322 BC, regarded Zeno of Elea as the first to use dialectic, engaging in arguments, the dialectic, based on premises of formal logic, on pure logical relations, not on the data of empirical experience. Pure logic. So, Zeno of Elea believes he can win the argument if he can show that the premises of the pluralists lead to contradictory or irrational conclusions. The pluralists believe that all of reality is fundamentally composed of certain elements, right? Either differing in qualities or quantities. That being is many. That the world is divisible with discrete units, in other words, right? Fundamentally, ultimately, the world has many discrete units, atoms or elements, that have being, that do not change. Zeno of Elea asserted that this means these different elements or atoms have dimensions extending out into space, and anything with dimensions, he argued, could be split apart or be a part of something else, which means they could be infinitely small or infinitely large, which would make time and space infinite. To him, that was absurd, because if some physical thing was infinitely large, it precludes the existence of anything else. Plurality, right? You see? So if in a logical flow he can show that something with dimensions takes up space, but it could be split and have parts, then something could be infinitely small or infinitely large. If it could be infinitely large, one item could be the whole thing, which is Parmenides' view, one body. Well, that refutes the pluralists. You get me? In addition, the pluralists believed in motion. It was key to the pluralist position that these atoms and elements are in motion. Either eternal motion or opposing forces in nature started the motion, or mind was behind the motion. But motion was key. There's becoming. Motion is change. And the pluralists believe this is what their physical senses observe. This motion and change is real. Well, Zeno of Elea argued that our physical senses deal only with appearances and not with reality. Merely what they appear to be to you and me. But it's not real. Just like you put an oar, a straight oar, into the water and it appears to bend. But you know it didn't bend. But it appears to bend, right? And that's what he's saying, that motion and change are nothing but appearances, not real. For Zeno of Elea, the concept of motion for discrete units, because that's what pluralists are saying, everything ultimately boils down to discrete units or elements or atoms. For Zeno of Elea, the concept of motion for discrete units or parts leads to absurdity. To prove his point, he used four arguments or paradoxes. A runner on a track, a race between a tortoise and Achilles, an archer and an arrow, as well as the problem of the relativity of motion that he describes, okay, which is a modern problem, the theory of relativity. You with the relativity of motion. There's nothing new under the sun. Okay, so let's work through these real quick here. So first, he presented a racetrack to argue that a runner only reaches the finish line, in a sense, if all reality is one, absolute being. Because if it's composed of fundamentally discrete units or parts, then to circle the track, the runner must traverse an infinite number of points in a finite number of moments. And you say, well, is that correct? See, rationalism will lead you to a good conclusion if the premise is true. Is it true that there's an infinite number of discrete units on the 400-meter track over there at the high school? I say, no, I don't think there's an infinite number of discrete units. Can it always half be divided into a half, into a half, into a half, into a half, into a half? And that's where he goes and says it can always be divided into a half. Never ending. Okay? That's his assumption. He doesn't know calculus, right? So he would say the runner would first need to reach the halfway point, then he would need to go halfway to the end from there, and another halfway, and another, all the way to infinity, never reaching the finish line. But you say, well, is that logic sound? Is it based on a real, true premise? I say no. I would argue no, right? But that's where he's arguing that back then, to them, against the pluralists, that everything's in discrete units or parts or elements. Well, he presents another argument of a race between a tortoise and Achilles. And in this, we're to think that the tortoise is brilliant and Achilles is not smart, because the tortoise gets Achilles to agree to give the tortoise a head start in this race. Zeno of Lea argues, if reality is fundamentally composed of units or discrete parts, as the pluralists assert, then every time that Achilles has caught up to where the tortoise was, the tortoise has moved on. And this process continues forever, with Achilles never catching up to the tortoise. And again, he has the idea then that an infinite series is inexhaustible. So both the tortoise and Achilles could not move, and thus the head start meant Achilles would never catch up to the tortoise. All was one. The third one he tried to argue is that he presented an archer and an arrow to argue that the idea of motion is an illusion. That an arrow in flight must always occupy a space equal to its length. Again, he's thinking about motion and space. An arrow in flight must always occupy a space equal to its length. But for an arrow to occupy a space equal to its length, at that moment, it must be at rest. Hence, the arrow occupies a space equal to its length. It must always be at rest. Hence, the arrow's motion is an illusion, because it's always occupying a space equal to its length. And it equals a space equal to its length when it's at rest. So it must always be at rest. I think it's how you define rest, you know, right? It's based on his premise. Well, fourth, he tried this. With the relativity of motion, and it's a problem that's perpetual today, right, with the theory of relativity. What he observed, Zeno of Elea, he observed that motion needs a clear definition and reference points. Now, you think you've been on the interstate where you've got a car next to you on a four-lane highway, and you're both going the same speed, and you look over, if you're the passenger, and it looks like the other car's not moving. Right? You've seen that, right? You're moving in the car and you look and you're sitting next to the person next to you and you look down, nothing's moving in the car. But you're going 70 down the road. It's a problem we're all quite familiar with. A passenger on an airplane, they're at rest. When you sleep in your bed at night, well, the earth upon which you are sleeping is moving several miles a second. Are you at rest? The earth is rotating on its axis right now, several miles a second. Are you at rest sitting there, Theramu, at the table? Gordon Clark summarizes Zeno's position as this. A body is at rest when two of its points are fixed against two points of its surroundings. Now consider the flight of an arrow. At any moment of the arrow's flight, its extreme points are coincident with two points of space. And this, he likes that where at any moment, like a photograph. At any moment of the arrow's flight, its extreme points are coincident with two points of space. That is, at any moment of its flight, it is at rest. And since this is true of any and every moment, it follows that the arrow is always at rest. It never moves. Motion is an absurdity. Because you have to say motion with regard to what? I'm standing here on the floor right here. Not moving. But I am moving. The earth is moving. Right? It's orbiting around the sun and it's revolving on its axis. There's tons of motion going on here, right? But you need reference points. At least two reference points. But this is something that it's the point upon which the pluralist position depends, because the fundamental atoms or elements must move to collide and form objects. So, following in the steps of his teacher, Parmenides, Zeno of Elea, his argument is that it's better to trust your reason than your physical senses. Which, you know, this is the debate then. Rationalism versus empiricism, way back then. You trust your reason, you trust your senses. Or is it a combination of both? And again, his arguments depend on whether his premises are true. So the next time we meet, these are all the pre-Socratics, okay? Milesians, Heraclitus, Pythagoras and his students, the Pythagoreans, Parmenides and the pluralists, and Zeno of Elea. They're the pre-Socratic philosophers, along with some sophists. Now, we're going to discuss the sophists with Socrates, because that's where it really gets discussed with Socrates and Plato. But that's, Lord willing, where we're moving. Then the next is the sophists, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. But understand this, okay? Based on the arguing that's taking place, at that time, by the end of the 5th century to 400 B.C., end of the 5th century to 400 B.C., going into the 4th century, into the 300s B.C., there was a rise of skepticism among the ancient Greek philosophers. All attempts to arrive at the nature of things seemed to have various problems. And some people questioned whether truth about the nature of things was attainable. And this is where Socrates will have debates in Plato's dialogue with the sophists, who were relativists. But you can't really know the truth of anything. Well, can you? Is there such a thing as justice and injustice and other things? Well, then, as well, as we said, the pre-Socratics are about the nature of things, and when we get to Socrates onward, then it's about political philosophy, about the nature of social arrangements. Not just us as individuals, and the arche and root of all things, but the nature of social arrangements, right? The polis. And that's that why we have that break between the pre-Socratics and the Socratics. So Lord willing, that's where we're moving, though, to the sophists, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, and then discussing republics in our journey through Athens. And then, Lord willing, we'll move on to Rome, then after that, and then after quite a bit of time there, to London, and eventually to America, Lord willing.